Hi, my name is Amber Dlugosh and I teach dual credit composition at Bolivar High School. This year took a turn that we could not have anticipated. I would have never guessed that I'd be finishing the school year out teaching at home with my dog Dottie, who you can hear walking across the floor right now. Though their senior year took a harsh turn and many are now facing tough realities, my students have continued to exude exemplary character. The stories and insights they've shared have challenged me to keep going and to see different perspectives. So I've asked them if they would share with you by reading a piece of their own choosing. In each episode, you'll hear from five members of the graduating class of 2020. I call this group of students the Good Guys, and I think you'll see why. I hope you enjoy another episode of Powerful Perspectives.
All right. Here we are, the final, last final of all time, College Comp, Part 2, Senior Year, Bolivar High School. My name's Drayden Thompson, and I am now a college kid, no longer a high schooler, be a freshman in college. And I'll be reading the story I wrote for our list writing assignment. It is called I Long For. And I chose this assignment because I believe it is about our situation we're in right now, and I believe it applies very well. And this one means a lot to me, and I'm proud of it. All right, let's get started. This is I Long For. As my sleeping schedule shifts to revolve around work rather than school, my days grow shorter and my nights longer. Even though my world seems very small with a repetitive schedule and a growing boredom, the world itself is in chaos all around me. The COVID-19 crisis has shifted the earth as we know it, and it's likely that the flow of our civilization will forever be faced by it. With the world being so loud day in and day out, my world suddenly feels quiet. This silence has given me time to reflect. Reflect that which I have lost and gained, and also how I and others are changing. But mostly I think of those things which have been stripped from us and how much I want them back, how much I long for them. I long to see others' faces with less fear or sadness. Where once people's faces seemed normal to me, now I notice these emotions more clearly. I long to share a laugh with all my friends in a group again. Something as simple as standing in a circle and talking sounds so relieving. I long to play out my last tennis season. Even though it was my first, I was excited to see how far I could take my talents. I long to sit down in a restaurant again. That simple atmosphere, along with a good meal and making friends with your server, is always one of my favorite times. Those 2:30 a.m. IHOP trips sound really nice. I long to see most of my friends who have been in prison for the past few weeks out of fear. It's okay, though. It's for the greater good. At least that's what I'm telling myself. I long to sit at a lunch table one more time and cherish that last moment which I took for granted. But what I miss the most over anything, where my passion lied the most over the last 4 years, I long to sing again. I long to sing with all those who share my passions and create something truly incredible. I sing to relieve the weight that I carry on me every day. When I sing, I feel full of life and love. I sing to inspire those who think they can't because I was in their exact position before and now I'm going to be performing at a collegiate level. I sing because I'm determined to make myself the best I can and prove to others that I have what it takes. I sing because I believe it's how I make my impact on people. If I knew I wouldn't be singing in high school again, I would have done so much more. I would have taken those underclassmen under my wing better so they could be built into incredible performers. I long for that chance to teach, to spread what little I can offer. This world is on hold, and I have lost things and will always long for them. But this is bigger than any of us. Even when things return to normal, or if they do, I will still long for many things. But there is one thing. One finality that always drives me through life and will forever. I long to make an impact. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Maya Montgomery. I'm a senior at Bolivar High School and a self-identified writer. Calling myself an author sounds pretentious. So in that vein, today I'll be reading a creative short story I wrote for my college composition class. I chose this mainly because while I love to write, I have a tendency to not finish projects. And this is the only story I've written in a while that feels finished, you know? Also, I'm quite proud of it, if I do say so myself. The title is Walmart Expedition. Tragedy struck at the Montgomery House one fateful Friday. I opened our linen cabinet in search of some toilet paper before an unfortunate incident happened and was stricken with horror to discover that there was only an empty plastic wrapping. Dread built in my throat when I realized I would have to traverse the great wasteland of a mid-pandemic Walmart. Before the great toilet paper shortage, I found a love letter to the people of Walmart in my Google Drive, celebrating them in all their eclectic, insane glory. On one Saturday afternoon, however, my feelings towards the patrons of Walmart could not be more different. We just needed toilet paper. We just needed toilet paper. The parking lot is edging on becoming a demolition derby. People are getting into social distance fistfights over the carts that workers have sanitized. Customers and workers are at odds, Karens and Kyles alike ganging up on workers restocking the baking supplies aisle. Madhouse, pure madhouse, really makes you wonder how we survived this long when our base instincts are every man for himself. Walmart becomes a thunderdome during quarantine. Now I know all those zombie movies were correct. People scatter at every sneeze and cough. Old people crash through crowds on mobility scooters. My mom sends me in with a hushed Lord's Prayer, iron cross, salt, and a surgical mask. I don't get a cart. I don't need a cart. Getting a cart is a sign of weakness, and they'll pick you off like a horse with a broken leg. If you're not willing to die over a supersized pack of tortillas, you will not survive. The Walmart visit uniform, quarantine edition, consists of tokens of safety from loved ones, family photos, last will and testament, things of that ilk, surgical masks, rubber gloves, and full-body Kevlar armor. Toddlers are not above shanking people for the last Kit Kat at the self-checkout line. The toilet paper aisle in Walmart is third to last. Before I can get my simple bounty, I have to glimpse carnage and unforeseen severity in every aisle I pass. The frozen food aisle has turned into a Himalayan wasteland. Pizzas are thawing as the doors yawn open. A mom in a homemade kerchief mask and LuLaRoe leggings is tussling with a teenager over a box of pizza rolls, 6 feet apart, of course. Someone has left fresh produce next to the discount pot pies. The Hispanic food aisle is mostly bare, save for the spiciest of salsas and this bottom-shelf brands of chips and tortillas that cannot legally be called that. Corn crisp snacks and Hispanic flour rounds, I'm looking at you. The bulk food aisle boils and slithers with crowds of bus-filling families and doomsday preppers. Men in camo hats and moms in long jean skirts throw out all notions of human decency in favor of getting a carton of instant oatmeal the size of a toddler. Someone escapes the aisle, brandishing a gallon jug of ketchup like Judith brandishing the head of Holofernes. Children scream. Adults cry. I walk on. The displays in the center of the gangway now have an iconic, threatening lilt to their messages. Half off, limited time, get now or never again. Downy dish soap is the best. It seems Cheez-It crisps are buy one, get one free. My mother has a stockpile of canned goods and unknown pickled substances in her panic room, crackers included. I bypass them and search for my true goal, toilet paper. I enter the aisle, and true to the tales of Twitter celebrities, the aisle is as barren as the Mojave. The echoing chaos around me hushes as I cross into ground zero of the grocery panic and pass dusty shelf after dusty shelf of sold-out toilet paper. Some poor sucker took the great value single-ply theme park stuff. There is one case left. It's a four-pack of the cheapest, worst toilet paper money can buy, but it's something other than paper towels and banana peels. No one wants to get that desperate. The Montgomery family is getting close, though. I reach out, and before my very eyes, an age-spotted, gnarled hand snags it from under me. Gaudy rings clink against metal as an old woman tosses the last toilet paper in Walmart out of my reach and into the overstuffed recesses of her Trojan horse of a grocery cart. Humanity has disappointed me at every single turn of this journey so far. This might as well happen. I sigh and go to inform my mother of my failure when a croaking, age-rasped voice calls out, "Were you looking for this, honey?" I turn around, heart in my throat, dry throat clicking as I swallow. The grandma holds up the toilet paper. Fluorescent lights halo around its surface, holy light bleaching the plastic wrap and linoleum floor in an anemic, nauseating white. I hear a chorus of angels buzz over the loudspeaker. Yes, ma'am, but you got there before me. Oh, no, I've got plenty at my house. I just wanted to make sure I had enough to survive this mess, she croaks. Take it. If you insist. Thank you. I take the toilet paper, hands shaking, and leave the aisle. The chaos outside greets me once again as workers with rubber gloves go to clean up a spill in the dairy aisle. People turn, slack-jawed, as I walk past, the MacGuffin of legends in my possession. Victory is mine, and I could slay a dragon. I leave Walmart after purchasing the toilet paper, and once I'm disinfected and safe, riding on my mom's magical steed, a 2020 Toyota 4Runner, I realize something. Someone's always going to be there to make sure you don't start considering the hygienic uses of apple peels and other such evil things. Humans are never as bad as you think. They're little oases of kindness in the great desert of the human condition. To lump all of humanity in the same rotten box as the people who lick ice cream and put it back on the shelf, steal from Girl Scouts, and put milk in before the cereal is disingenuous to the bastions of humanity's best. Thanks, Toilet Paper Grandma. Our hygiene is indebted to you.
Hey, it's Abby. If you don't know me, I don't really have a lot of words to describe myself. I don't really fit in with a lot of social labels, and I don't like to fit into them. I'm different. That's all I can really say. I'm going to be reading a piece that I just wrote for college composition. It's about independence and anxiety, and I'm reading it to maybe give hope to people that struggle with anxiety and don't just see it as a mountain that they can't get past, because you can. Now, sorry if you're hearing a lot of background noise. There are a lot of people in my house right now. So growing up, I always considered myself very independent, but I had no idea how that would take shape in my teenage years and what obstacles were coming. I had no clue what obstacles were coming. As a child, I liked to do things on my own way. I didn't have to answer to anyone or deal with anyone. I had these big dreams and ambitions, and I had a lot of motivation to reach for them, working around any obstacles that could be in my way. The role models in my life, mainly my parents, set me up this way and would later build my success from the ground up. My independence flowed over into my schoolwork, my job, my friendships, and my hobbies. Also, growing up, I received an allowance. It wasn't that much, but it made me feel mature. I was doing chores around the house, for a little bit of spending money, I was being productive and useful. I was learning that working for something generates a reward for the work you've put forth. In this case, my reward was money that I could spend however I desired. As I grew up, things tended to get more expensive, and I was given more work, but I earned a higher allowance. This made me feel more independent as I went through my adolescent years. Specifically, when I turned 16, I wanted to get my license immediately. I studied hard, I practiced many hours, and even though I failed the first time, which definitely felt like a setback to the independence that I cultivated, I passed a second time. I felt I was rewarded for the work I put forth into getting my driver's license. I was faced with an obstacle and I maneuvered past it, but now there's a new obstacle. What good is a license without a car? My parents made me a deal. They'd buy me a car, an old used car, if I got a job and paid them back for the car. I wouldn't have to do my chores anymore, but I wouldn't receive that allowance. And they figured out that if I worked 20 hours a week, which isn't a lot paired with school, I'd have enough money to pay off my car, still have a little bit of money to spend. I felt excited. This felt like a step in growing completely independent. I felt motivated to get a part-time job to pay it off as quickly as possible. I applied to many places, and after a week, I got a call back from the local Wendy's, saying that they were desperate for part-time employees and asked me to interview the next day, to which I accepted. At the interview, I was asked a few questions before receiving an offer, and I was due to start in exactly a week. Another obstacle had been maneuvered and overcome, getting an interview. Not only did I have an interview, I also had the job. I was so excited because I felt more independent, but I was soon faced with a new obstacle, anxiety. In my early high school years, I visited a therapist and was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, among other things. It had somewhat of an effect on my schoolwork, but I had grown accustomed to high school and the effect of anxiety was less prevalent. Now that I was in a new environment, doing things I'd never done before, around complete strangers, needless to say, the anxiety went through the roof. But I knew I had to pay for my car somehow, so I tried to use this motivation to curb the anxiety. My first day of work rolls around. My manager's name was Kiki. She was very nice to me, which was relaxing. I felt like maybe I could get through it. She gave me a tour, introduced me to that night's crew, and gave me a computer for orientation. After watching videos about the store, how to run, and how to do various things in it, she once again welcomed me and sent me home. On my next shift, I was actually being trained. My trainer, and I can't remember his name, but he was very nice and introduced me to a lot of other new people. My manager and my trainer helped me grow very comfortable very quickly, and I soon made a lot of friends with the other workers, and the anxiety lessened over time. After 2 weeks on a Monday, I noticed a spike in my bank account balance. I received my first paycheck. Crazy, right? It was small, but much more than any allowance I had earned in a two-week period. I was ecstatic. The independence was truly starting to shine through, and I made my first car payment. In just under a year at my job, I soon paid off my car, and it was now mine. I felt as if a weight had been lifted off my shoulders, like I now knew that it was truly mine. And I was more independent because I didn't have to answer to anybody about my car, except in certain times, of course, because it was still in my parents' name because I was underage and stuff. But not only did I feel more independent, it also made my work feel more rewarding. This helped with certain anxieties that I felt about working there. Also, due to my longevity, surprisingly, not a lot of workers make it that long, a year. I not only made many crew friends, but I learned a lot about the job and was offered training for a promotion. And even though I'm no longer at that job, I'm still thankful for what I learned from it. I feel more independent, and I'm a few short months from moving into my own place, the final step. I certainly have my old job and my parents to thank for that, for helping me stretch myself into more of an independent person. And getting through the anxiety was hard, but... And it was painful to stretch into a new position, a new environment, a scary environment. But once you stretched, it was less uncomfortable and it got easier. And I just want to communicate that just because you feel anxiety about a specific thing or maybe a specific place or person, it'll be uncomfortable to stretch yourself into this new position or this new friendship or relationship or whatever it may be. It's going to be like uncomfortable to stretch yourself into it first, but once you get used to it, it could be very rewarding. It could be very rewarding, and it's definitely worth a try. Thank you.
What's up, guys? I'm Dylan Rowell. I'm a male or student at BHS. I'm not really sure which one we're supposed to put in there. But I'm going to read a couple like top 10 / lists I made during free writing. I'm choosing this because I don't like my lists or my list writing or my story. And I also just wanted to share these a little bit more. So the first one is a top 10 NBA players of all time. We'll start at some honorable mentions or people that I think might take some spots over later in their career. KD, Giannis, Stephen Curry, and Luka Doncic is really young, but he's already so good, so we'll see. But now we'll rank them. Number 10, I have Bill Russell. He has 11 rings, and that's insane. But he also played in really old times, and so the NBA wasn't very good back then, so that's why he's at 10. Wilt Chamberlain. He could arguably be higher, probably, but I put him here just because I don't think his time was very good, so I think his stats look better. But, I mean, he did score 100 points in one game, 50 rebounds, but he never won a ring, so how high can you really put him either if rings mean a lot to people? So, number eight, Hakeem Olajuwon, he won two rings. He took advantage when Michael Jordan retired, and he won two rings there, and I think a couple MVPs, I'm not really sure. Seven is Larry Bird, one of the greatest small forwards of all time, played for the Celtics. Number six, Kobe Bryant, won five rings. I think only one MVP, which is crazy, but probably the second greatest shooting guard of all time. Number five, Shaq, debatably the most dominant player of all time just because nobody could guard him. He won four NBA championships. At number four, I have Magic Johnson, probably the best point guard of all time. He won, I forget, I don't know how many rings he won, but he won a few. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar won some rings, the all-time leading scorer, like career-wise. Number two, Michael Jordan. People say he's the GOAT. Won six rings, a bunch of MVPs. But number one, I have LeBron James, and I'd love to debate with anyone that disagrees. I just will. So the next list I'm going to read are my top 10 favorite movies. We'll start with some honorable mentions. I got Empire Strikes Back, Rocky, Tommy Boy, Monsters, Inc., Endgame, Marriage Story, Us, and The Dark Knight Rises. All great movies. But they just didn't crack the top 10. So, number 10 is Schindler's List. If you haven't seen this, it's like it hits. Like, I'll warn you before you watch it to go in being ready for some, I don't know how to explain it, some things that maybe you don't want to see, but like, it's good to see because it's about the Holocaust and this guy trying to save Jews from a German trying to save Jews from other Germans. So number nine, Shawshank Redemption, a classic. It's about a guy going to prison, and I don't want to say too much because it'll spoil. Number eight, Seven, super good movie, kind of gruesome, but if you've ever heard the "What's in the Box," that's what that's from. Super good. Number seven, Get Out. Great movie. Love Jordan Peele. Number six is Interstellar. That's a space movie. It's crazy. The music is great on that one. Five is Fight Club. Super good movie. Some crazy things happen. Kind of confusing, but I like it. Number four, Infinity War. It's the best Marvel movie for sure. Had me going crazy in the theaters. Number three, I have Inception. Leonardo DiCaprio is so good. So, I mean, anything with him, I'm just going to. So that's a great movie. Dark Knight is number two. The Joker, so good in that movie. Great acting. It's just, obviously, it's my favorite superhero movie. Number one, probably haven't heard of it, but if you have, you know, Shutter Island, man. So good. Like, I can't tell you anything about it because it'll spoil the movie. That's just a weird thing, but that's just how it goes. And so the last list, if you watched my Flipgrid, I've already shared this one, but I thought I'd just share it because it's a pretty big one that most people can relate to. I ranked all the Pixar movies. So at number 22, the very bottom, I have Cars 2. It's one of the few Pixar movies that I actually just don't like. I think it's terrible. 21 is Brave. It's just not very good, I don't think. Cars 3 is number 20. Once again, it's just like, it's better than Cars 2, but like, still bad. 19, Finding Dory. When I first watched this, I thought I liked it, but I rewatched it recently and I was kind of disappointed. So it's just like, meh. 18, Bug's Life. I'm sorry, Mr. Lugash, but it's just, I kind of find it boring. I'm sorry, I just don't, I don't like it. 17, The Good Dinosaur. Tanner really hates this movie, and he let me know that. But I thought it was, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, nothing crazy about it, but I mean, it's just a cute little movie. 16, I have Cars. I think Cars is overrated. I don't know. I just don't like it that much. I don't like the series. 15, Inside Out. Pretty good, but, I mean, Pixar's just amazing. So, 14, The Incredibles 2. I mean, name a better, like, company that consistently makes good sequels than Pixar. Like, they just kill it every time. 13, the new one, Onward. I really like that one. I really like that one. It was a pleasant surprise. 12, I have Toy Story 4. The animation in this movie was fantastic, but other than that, it's just pretty good. 11, Monsters University. I really liked how they didn't make a sequel, because I don't think Monsters, Inc. needed a sequel, but they showed how everyone got there, and I liked the way they did that. Showed their come up. 10 is Coco. I feel like it's one of the most underrated ones. It's really good. I hadn't seen it until like a year after it came out, but that was a mistake. Number 9 is WALL-E. Everyone loves WALL-E. Just great. 8 is Toy Story 3. I mean, probably the best third movie in a series I can think of that's not like a book. Yeah, for sure. 7 is Up. Love Up. Everyone loves Up. Cute story. Beginning makes everybody getting their feels real quick. Number 6 is Finding Nemo, a Pixar classic. But I think it's a tiny bit overrated. But not to say that it isn't great, because it's still number 6. 5 is my most underrated movie, I think, is Ratatouille. I love Ratatouille. Just everything about it. 4, The Incredibles. Such a great story. It's great. And honestly, looking at this list, I've made it, and I rewatched Toy Story 1 recently, and I had that at number 2, but I'm actually going to move that to number 5, and then we're going to make Ratatouille 4 and move everything up. So The Incredibles is actually 3, and number 2, Toy Story 2, the best Toy Story in my opinion. It's got everything. It's got the battle with Zurg between Buzz Lightyear and him, and then you get the new characters. But then my number 1 Pixar movie is Monsters, Inc. Yeah, it always has been, and it probably always will. All right, that's all for me.
Let's go to bah. Wow. Hey. Yo, it's your most annoying favorite Asian half something. I don't know, man. But, yo, name's Corey Siegfried. You might know, might have heard of me, you know. I'm that crazy, annoying Asian guy. But, you know, whatever. I don't know. It's... So what... Okay, let's get straight into it, you know. So what am I going to be reading? Well... it's kind of hard to explain. The quick way is, it's my final for my class. More in depth, kind of picking up my brain, pretty much. And I chose this piece because, well, I wrote it, and I don't know, think it might be an interesting thing, I suppose. So, well, I guess we can get right into it. So, the beginning starts. Corey's idea of why Project Cars have become a therapy. The story of why I enjoy having a project car. What kind I want it to be, and how such a big piece of metal has become my only therapist. Kind of deep, you know? So, yes, it would be cool to have any project car, but what I want is a car that you can drift. I want a car where you can take the next corner as fast as you can. Something that can take you down the track sideways. I want what they call a JDM car, which stands for the Japanese domestic market, you know? I found a new love for these types of cars during all this quarantine, honestly, with watching them on YouTube and just seeing different pictures of the styles that people have. I've seen how much fun they can be to work on and just drive. I've always loved to drive ever since I got my permit. It was like a sense of freedom, which isn't something I honestly get too often. I had never honestly been a car person before. Like, I'd watch NASCAR, you know, and I'd get the appeal to go fast, and I'd been to a couple of car shows, but I never understood why. Why would people buy parts? Why would they spend thousands of dollars on one small part to fix a perfectly good car? Why would they go and take off a pretty much brand new part and just spend more money on this big thing of metal that got you from point A to B, you know? I found myself falling in love with cars, honestly, a couple of years after I got my license. My best friend Tyler and I would drive around, but we never really worked on them because we had really old cars and couldn't really go anywhere. But this all changed June 5th, 2019, when my best friend Tyler got a new car. Now, it was still old, and he got it as a wrecked car, actually, and we had to fix it up. But the thing is, he still drove it every day. It was a run and drive when he got it. It was a 2006 Mazda Miata. We would work on his car all day, and this honestly brought us closer. It almost close enough to where it was almost like we were brothers. This, I guess it is kind of cliche, but you know, it formed a bond that could never be broken, a bond that could never be lost. But to continue, I've learned that driving and working on cars, it's a hobby. A passion, something to relieve your stress on, you know, just small little things, but it's something bigger than just that. It's something that's freeing from everything else in the world. I use this as a way to show myself more than I ever knew I honestly ever could. I use this as a way to hang out with my friends or so we can talk and catch up on life. Someone that I can talk to that understands, which my family will never understand. My family doesn't get why I like to spend my time on this piece of metal that is supposed to get me from point A to B. They don't see why I can spend so much money on gas some days or money to make my car just a bit faster. What is it about going fast that makes me so happy? So I found a quote. It's from a movie, Ford versus Ferrari. It's by Carroll Shelby. There's a point at 7,000 RPMs where everything fades. The machine becomes weightless. It just disappears. All that's left, a body moving through space and time. 7,000 RPMs, that's where you meet it. You feel it coming. It creeps up near you and asks you a question, the only question that really matters. Who are you? So, I don't know, that quote, it shows a lot, I guess, just about where a car can take you. Yes, this is a hard thing to do, and it's a very expensive hobby, and it's a very crazy thing with everything that you can do with your car. But with all these things, there are the dangers of doing anything with a car, from not having your car run to honestly death. It's a hobby that can be a lot of fun, but very dangerous. But in the end, it's always worth it. You have to think about a lot of things while you work on your car, while you're driving as fast as you can. Your family, the people you love, and those who love you. It can be a hard thing to balance, from forcing yourself to not buying a new part to honestly knowing what can make your car as safe as it can be. You have to overcome a lot of fears and just get into it. You need to know when enough is enough and when it's honestly not safe. You have to know when your family comes first. There's another quote. It's from Tokyo Drift, yeah, by Hanmu. Life's simple. You make choices and you don't look back. So to continue on, you learn a lot of things by working on cars or just driving as fast as you want. You learn a lot about yourself. There are a lot of things I've honestly learned about myself while driving. You find what you love, who you love. You find family with your friends. I don't have friends, I have family. There's another small quote in there that I said but didn't realize it, but it's by Don Toretto from Furious 7. And I'll repeat that real quick. You find family with your friends. I don't have friends, I have family. So to continue on, you find your reasons to keep going some days. The blood spilled over this piece of metal, that's become an embodiment of yourself, like almost another part of your soul. And to finish this off, this pile of metal, this death machine, this lover, this money pit, this car. But to end it off, one thing that to go back on from the first quote by Carroll Shelby, one thing that a lot of car guys have figured out, or people who do their passion, I guess, is who are you?
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I know that these five seniors really appreciate your time and your ears. They have boldly shared their own stories and perspectives, and I celebrate that in them. It's very brave and courageous of them to do. In our class, we center all that we do around one common saying: stories create connection, and connection creates understanding. And it's my hope that that's what's happened here today. Thank you again.